Right, we've got our second share for this afternoon, and it is Helena, who's come from Reading, well, from around here, and her first meeting was Living Sober in Bracknell, and I don't know how long ago, but probably another million years ago. So I'll hand over to you, Helena. Thank you.
Hello everyone, I'm Helena and I'm an alcoholic.
Hello.
I'm a very grateful alcoholic. You know, I got up this morning and I did my prayers and I looked out the window and it was fairly kind of trying to, you know, the sun was trying to come through. And I thought to myself, I've got so much to be grateful for. And I do. And, you know, and it's all thanks to this fellowship, you know, to AA, to this program, and to people, to the people in the rooms. I haven't rehearsed. I haven't really thought much about what I'm going to say. I just want to really tell you my story because I came into these rooms in 1978. So, God willing, this year I'll have been here 39 years. And, you know, that actual number is important to me. It's important to me because, you know, it is in gratitude. You know, to these meetings, to the people, and to the love actually that was shown me. And you know, I feel emotional actually saying that because you know, when I came in, my first meeting was actually a Thursday night, Bracknell Living Sober, and that meeting was on at the same time as the Highland Fling. They used to practice the Highland Fling in the other room. And when I made that phone call to AA in the morning, it was to the Samaritans. We didn't have a telephone duty set up. Well, we had a few people that did telephone work, but we didn't have the telephone room set up. So my GP told me that he could no longer help me when I went in there, you know, moaning about the boyfriend who'd left me. And what I was looking for was either antidepressants or pills, Valium, to help me, you know, get through until I could afford the next bottle. Anyway, this particular morning turned round, and I was obviously reeking of alcohol. I was bloated, and he said, I can't do anything for you, you have to ring Samaritans, here's the number. And I was so annoyed. I thought, how dare he, you know, my hair was a mess, I was stinky, and I thought, how dare he say that to me, that I have to ring Alcoholics Anonymous. So I kind of slunk out of there, and I no longer held down a job, and I was still in the family house just about. And I thought, and I, of course the shakes were coming in, the, you know, the shakes, the compulsion, where am I going to get that next drink from? And I picked up the phone and someone phoned me back, and it was a lady, interestingly enough, we used to call Reading Anne, and she lived quite near the Oxford Road, and she was very, you know, instrumental in me actually getting to these meetings. And sadly, she, you know, she came for a few years afterwards, but none of us knew what happened to her. But I owe a debt of gratitude to her because her and her husband picked me up and they took me to the Living Sober meeting in Bracknell. And I was petrified. I wanted to back out. The shakes had fully come in. I felt panicky. I felt ill, actually. I felt really ill. And physically, I probably was quite ill because I was quite swollen. So anyway, it was the worst meeting in my head that I could have been taken to because it was full of Americans. And not only was it full of Americans, but they were loud, they were confident. There was quite, and actually there was quite a cross section. It was an open meeting, and they didn't sit like this. You know, I couldn't have sat sort of slunk in the corner somewhere. I had to sit facing because the seats went round in a square. And, you know, they were well dressed. In my head, I thought, what am I doing here? What am I doing here? And they were so positive and full of joy and enthusiasm for this program. And I thought, this is some sort of cult, you know. And I wanted the chair to like swallow me up. And they came up to me at the end of the meeting and gave me their numbers. Anyway, to cut a long story, I was in a fog and nothing really, I didn't think anything had kind of sunk in. But Anne told me that she was going to pick me up and she would take me to my next meeting at Watlington Street in Reading. And I'm pleased to say that actually that meeting is still there today on a Sunday morning. And that was another eye-opener, because I got to that meeting and it wasn't as decorated as it is now. If any of you go to that meeting, it was, in my head, again, it was quite a gloomy room. And we went down these kind of rickety stairs and, you know, and we had a resident mouse, actually. And the meeting was like this. It was a table at the front and people facing. And sometimes we'd sit there and this little mouse would sort of run at the back, you know. So again, it was, what am I doing here? You know, I'm better than these people. And I don't know if any of you will kind of identify with that. It's this kind of, I felt like the lowest of low, but veered to I'm better than, you know. It's this kind of, there was no balance. You know, I'm either better than you or I'm worse than you. And there were more kind of low, what we would term low bottom drunks at the Watlington Street meeting. And sufficient to, I mean, there were so many characters. It was just unbelievable. There weren't many women, but there was an old timer there. There was a couple, and you know, it was the love of these people that kept me coming back, actually. And they spoke about physical, mental, and spiritual, this being a physical, mental, and spiritual illness. And I just zeroed in on the physical. I thought, yeah, you know, I do look a mess. I don't feel very well. I had age for me, that I wasn't very old in age terms. So physically, I recovered really quickly, but the mental and the spiritual has actually been a whole years of recovery. And you know, and this is why I'm so grateful that I keep coming back to AA, because if it wasn't for AA, if it wasn't for all you people, if it wasn't for, you know, people showing their time, their patience, their tolerance with me, you know, I wouldn't be sitting here today. And I would say I was a dry drunk for, I was probably a dry drunk for about kind of 2 years. I wouldn't have thought so at the time, because, you know, obviously I thought ego, they spoke about ego. I didn't have an ego. I was petrified of everyone. I was shy. I was nervous. So how could I have an ego? But of course, I know what ego is today. And, you know, and the characteristics, I was told that the characteristics of this illness are self-centeredness and gross childishness. And again, you know, oh, maybe them. So I was told, listen to the similarities. Now, there was a lot of men in that meeting that had 30 years of drinking, 30, 40, some of them, sort of, they were all Army, Navy stories. This was, you know, the straightforward chairs. And I'd, you know, strut in because I lost the weight, started to get my hair cut, and I'd grace, you know, their present, you know, I'd come in and here I am. And I got a lot of attention because, as I say, I was single, young and female, you know, and I lapped it all up. And, you know, they'd pat me on the head and, you know, and I thought that would be fine. But it wasn't fine. If someone came near me and said, how are you? Fine, fine. The minute I got the ex-boyfriend back, because he started to show an interest because I looked better and I, you know, obviously wasn't totally out of it, you know, I thought, I still need to go to AA, but I'll just dip in. So he used to pick me up after the meeting at Watlington Street, and I thought this was great, you know, I could just dip into AA. I'll listen to all these boring old farts with their, you know, navy and drinking stories. And as soon as the serenity prayer was said, off I trot, you know, up those rickety stairs. I get in the car and, you know, thought I had it made. And my next quest was that, you know, okay, I haven't had a drink today. You know, he's going to marry me and everything's going to be all right. Well, he was probably actually the biggest womanizer in Reading, I found out afterwards. But, you know, people that have lived in Reading all their life, not of a certain generation, probably know him well. But anyway, you know, I was convinced that I, like everything else, I was convinced that I was special and different, you see. You know, this is quite an important thing for me to remember. Because, you know, there have been many times in my recovery, you know, where that those two lovely words have kind of, well, I'm special, you know, I'm different. It was like, you know, the look for similarities. There weren't a lot of Eastern European people over then. But you see, I was different to all of you because my parents were Polish and my first language was Polish. So how could I identify? You know, the Polish were big drinkers, you know. My parents had massive parties and, you know, and vodka was kind of quite the norm in our house. And but anyway, I digress. After about a couple of years, I was deeply, deeply unhappy. I was scared. I was scared going into work. I was scared of people. I was staying away from a drink, but it wasn't. I wasn't getting this joy, you know. I wasn't feeling the feelings that people were sharing, or I could see in people's eyes, and you know. Service as well. I hadn't in that period, you know, given myself wholly to AA. I hadn't, you know, sort of tried to get out of me and help other people because I was too focused on this guy who disappeared anyway, which was a godsend. But, you know, it was one of those old timers, and people here might probably know him, Michael Kevin. Now, Michael Kevin would walk miles for a 12-step call. And, you know, he was, I found him to be a tolerance tester sometimes, but that guy always used to grab me before I went shooting off, and he'd say, how are you really? And he never actually let me go without me trying to respond more than saying I'm fine. And, you know, we didn't have mobile phones there, and I did give him my number, and he did used to ring me, and I used to think, oh no, what does he want? You know, he'd ring me to see how I was. And, you know, that guy was very big in, you know, in me sitting here. And, you know, I needed to change. And he actually said to me, you need to get a sponsor. And I did get a sponsor. And to me, that was that, you know, people speak about spiritual awakenings, but I wouldn't say that I wanted the big, you know, the flash almost like what Bill W. had, you know, that had to do for me what he had, this flash, you know, when he was in the drying out unit. But for me, it was those things that were spiritual awakenings. It was the fact that, you know, that he said, you need to do a step 4 and 5. You need to get rid of these feelings. You need to do this. And me listening, that was the, you know, spiritual turnaround. And I asked my sponsor, I asked this lady, she was Tokyo Jean, she was called. She sponsored a lot of people. But looking back, I kind of looked upon her. I thought she was going to mummy me, you know. She was this wonderful American loud woman, big hair, big winged glasses. You remember her, don't you, Mick? And she took me on, bless her. And I did my first step 4 and 5 with her. And she lived in this fabulous manor type house. And I remember going, you know, I wrote my first step 4 and 5. And you see, again, that was another awakening, because I wrote it as a life story. And actually, looking back, it was me just getting rid of all this rubbish, this ton of, like a sack of rocks that I carried around. I couldn't face anyone, you know, directly in the eyes. And, you know, that woman, she spent all night with me and listening. And a lot of it was probably so much, you know, well, but actually a lot of anger, a lot of fear, a lot of anger, and a lot of, you know, stuff that I'm so grateful that I got the, you know, privilege of doing with her. And when I did that, we talked about it, and, you know, so I did like a step 5, and then she asked me to burn it. She had an open fire and we burnt it. And again, you know, it was about 4 in the morning. She drove me back to my place. Now, this lady could not drive, bless her. But she wasn't used to driving. Her husband, who was very big in Al-Anon, he used to always drive her, but he had obviously gone to bed. And I must admit, you know, she said, that's all right, we'll get, she had an automatic, thank God. And there was hardly anyone on the road. And, you know, and I was like praying. It was probably my first or second prayer, because I did drive then. And, you know, she said, that's all right, higher power will, you know, get us there and get us back. And actually it did, it worked. But what I'm trying to say was that was another turning point, because, you know, this woman had given up her time, you know, her time to listen to me. And she did not reject me when I told her all what I thought was my innermost secrets that nobody else had done. You know, she accepted me. And, you know, to me, that was the beginning of, you know, another alcoholic showing love to another alcoholic. And, you know, she helped me a lot, because I used to phone, as I say, she was very big on, you know, she wanted me to, she felt that the steps, and she believed this, and everything she said, I believed in. She said that, you know, the steps are for you to enjoy life and to live life freely and in balance. And, you know, I remember phoning her saying, oh, I've been invited to this disco. It was a work thing. I worked with a lot of quite young people, and one of the guys there was a DJ at a club. And I was invited along. It was a big sort of like company thing. And I remember ringing her saying, and this is my first kind of social thing, and saying, oh, you know, I've been invited, but, oh, I don't think I can go. She said, right, phone me tomorrow and let me know how it went. And, you know, and that was it. And I listened to her because, you know, I believed, I didn't have a higher power of my own then, but I believed that she believed in a higher power. And when she first used to, you know, when I first used to pray, I didn't know what to pray to, but I trusted and I knew that she had a belief, so I used to pray to whatever she believed in, and that helped me tremendously in the early days. And, you know, and that's how it started. I started to, you know, do the steps to the best of my ability. I started to do a lot of service. I was pushed into service. I wasn't asked whether I wanted to do certain things. If a service position came up, I was nominated. I wasn't actually asked whether I wanted to go and think about it. I was asked, you know, the secretary's coming up, literature. You know, in those days we smoked in the meetings. If ashtrays needed doing, we did them. And I went in 12-step calls. And, you know, and all those things helped me to keep coming back. And I do believe that service is a huge, huge part of recovery for me. I can only speak for me, but, you know, people that I've sponsored, I always try and bang on about service because, I know it sounds like lecturing, but, you know, for this alcoholic, the self-centeredness, you know, I need to get out of myself. I need to listen. And I also need to give back what was freely given to me. And, you know, this is what it's about. And, you know, I'd like to sort of sit here and say, yes, the rest of the years were hunky-dory. They weren't hunky-dory, but they were... And they have been up to now. It has been an amazing, amazing journey. And I would not change it for anything. You know, I've had many sponsors in recovery simply because my first sponsor went back to the States and then I found someone else. And each time it's been an amazing relationship. I think sponsorship is very, very critical. It's very vital. And even today, I need to be an open book. I need to be able to go to someone and say to them, look, you know, this is how it is, or I need help, or what am I doing? Because the longer I go in sobriety as well, the longer I can start thinking. And I've always been great at rationalizing. And one of those rationalizing was, you know, well, I'll take this risk. I've been around, you know, long enough to know that I may not pick up a drink over this. I might get into a bit of trouble over this. But, you know, I'm going to do it because I'm going to take that risk, especially in relationships. That's how I used to be in relationships. I went through a phase where I decided I was going to meet an AA guy. You know, this AA meets boy at AA campus, and it's in the reading somewhere. And I went to Bristol to a convention, and I was sober a couple of years, and I met this guy across the room, exactly as it says. I thought, oh, he's the one, you know. And anyway, we got it together for a weekend. And he came up to visit me, and we were going to move in. And then the warning bells, you know. And then, you know, I phoned my sponsor up and said, oh, you know, I've had a great time down at this convention, met so-and-so, you know. But that put the fear of what's it in me. Oh, I think it's... And she said, you know, I remember her saying to me, no emotional involvements for at least a year to 18 months. And the biggest thing that apparently people can drink on in early sobriety is finance or romance. And romance is a biggie. It's a huge biggie. I'd like to say that, oh, then I went through a phase where I dated men outside of AA, and that was fine. That was okay. When they found out that I didn't drink, I became a bit of a taxi service, you know. But anyway, that's by the by. But I did meet my ex-husband, and that, you know, I'm still grateful to that relationship because I have two children, sobriety babes, and they're adults now. And, you know, I absolutely, the love I have for those children is just, you know, amazing. And, you know, thank God and thank, you know, AA, they haven't actually ever seen me pick up a drink. They know a lot about AA and they know about bits of the program. But, you know, to them, it's still kind of difficult. They know that I have, you know, most, well, my closest friends are in AA, but they can't fathom because they haven't, you know, seen me drink, thank God. And, you know, we have amazing conversations. And my daughter married a couple of years ago, and my son lives in Canada, and actually I've been privileged to be able to go there the last, I think I've been going for the last 5 years. I go in the summer, and I go to AA in Canada, and and I've traveled, you know, obviously to other places in sobriety. And, you know, when you walk into a room abroad, anywhere abroad, and you see the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, and in Canada they do it slightly different. One of the meetings that I go to, in that they say the Serenity Prayer at the beginning of the meeting, and they say the Lord's Prayer afterwards. But, you know, it doesn't matter. It's the same message. You get the same welcome. You get phone numbers given to you. You get, you know, and you feel part of. Where on earth, you know, where could you find this? And I know people here in this room that have traveled abroad and, you know, been to conventions and, you know, and we are part of something so big and so spiritual. That, you know, it's just, it's amazing. And, you know, I'm still kind of like dumb, you know, I'm awestruck by AA. I haven't yet, and there's still a yet, I haven't managed to go to a world convention, but, you know, there's still a yet, and I'm hoping to. You know, AA was forbidden. I will touch on this briefly. I have quite an extended family in Poland, actually, and that was a wonderful thing. You know, when Poland was under the communist government, they weren't allowed AA. You weren't allowed to have closed meetings. But, you know, it's opened up in AA. It's opened up in Russia. It's, you know, and it is just an amazing fellowship. And but I will touch on this. You know, I was told by my sponsor that I have to work for this program. She said to me that if I gave you sobriety in a box with a big ribbon on it saying sobriety, you wouldn't want it. And I sat there thinking, yes, I bloody do, give it to me, because I didn't want to do anything. I didn't feel, I was a victim when I came in here. You know, everyone had done something to me. And so I couldn't for a long time fathom how these simple steps and traditions could help me. I couldn't fathom how, you know, me looking at myself and my defects could help me. Of course, now I know different, but I had to make the effort. I had to pick up that phone. I had to do the writing. I had to share honestly. I couldn't, I couldn't come in here, and I did for a long time. I'd be asked to do a chair, and I'd sort of think, oh, what do they need to hear? You know, it's just so pat, pat. But of course, that's rubbish, because it wasn't self-honest, you know. I need to be honest, and I need to be self-honest. And that's where, you know, people close to me can kind of just say a word, or, you know, so, well, do you think maybe this? And this is what's so important. And, of course, being there for the newcomer, you know, it's quite sad. And I don't want to sound... I don't mean this as a judgmental thing, but I do have this thing that a lot of people, you know, they come to AA for many years, and, you know, and they get their life together, and suddenly there comes a point where they kind of, you know, slope off. You don't see them, you know. And thank God, you know, to today this hasn't happened to me. I don't want to just go, you know, think, oh, I'm too tired to go to that meeting. I know it all. And I learn so much from the newcomers, because I'm reminded the longer, the further you go from that, you know, we're all one drink away from a drunk. And the thing is, and it is just for today, and, you know, I can forget, and I don't want to forget. I don't want to forget what those, and for me, it wasn't so much physically, but it was mentally. I was broken mentally. And I hated myself, and it was not very far from a suicidal journey for me. So, you know, I don't want to go there, and I don't want to die an alcoholic death. And, you know, and thanks to a faith in a higher power, thanks to all of you people, and I know I've probably rambled on and on, you know, I'd like to say thank you, and keep coming back, and it works if you work it. Thank you.
Thank you,
Helena. Yeah, thank you. Oh, that was lovely. Just quickly, I love the message and the positivity, and that idea of, which I haven't heard it expressed, but it's what I feel, that if someone gave me a box with a ribbon on and said, here's sobriety, now I've been in a while, I totally understand why I wouldn't want that. Mm-hmm. But when you first come in, of course, that's all you want. So I suppose it's just slowly, slowly. But yeah, how wonderful, and how wonderful to hear that your children haven't seen you have a drink. Funnily enough, I became a granny at the weekend, last weekend, and so I wasn't hearing you say that, because my children are, well, different ages, but I suppose they've had half their lives with me drinking and half not. But then hearing you say that, I thought, oh yeah, how fantastic if I could, you know, have grandchildren who never see me drink, and you often hear about people who aren't allowed to see their grandchildren and all that. Well, day to time, that's not going to happen to me. So, you know, that was inspirational and lovely, and thank you so much for coming along. Thank you very much. I think, I don't know, Bernard, do we want a tea break?
Right, yeah.
A little break? Okay, we're going to break for 5 minutes.